Good afternoon. Everybody go ahead and be seated. All right, the next case on our docket today is docket number 64569, Harrison v. Reitman. Counsel, are we ready to proceed?
Your call's ready, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Olson, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Justices Cherry, Perigary, and Douglas. My name is John Olson. I'm here representing the appellant Vivian Harrison, who's present in the courtroom. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Yes, you may.
Members of the court, this case represents the prime example as to why there ought not to be blanket witness immunity in the state of Nevada. Now, I say the prime example because it is probably one of the hardest cases and one of the cases most rife with abuse that we will see. It's a prime example and an extreme example in some cases because of three aspects of this case. The first is the ex parte nature of the motion that was supported by Dr. Reitman's affidavit. The second is that Dr. Reitman was not judicially sanctioned ahead of time. In many cases, the immunity extended is quasi-judicial immunity. That is, such as in
Also, while you're searching for that, to be in all candor, the concern for the court is the issue as to the extension of immunity for non-judicial appointees, so to speak, as you're outlining. And the other is this kind of cross issue that we're getting into that considering a party a patient to bring them under or within the statute for malpractice.
Yes.
Why this is not shouldn't have been a defamation opposed to a malpractice situation. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of the thoughts as we're trying to square up this case and going forward.
I agree because Sahara and Circus are both cases involving defamation, and I know where the concern comes from. This case, however, did not involve a suit brought because of defamatory statements. This case was brought on the malpractice issue because of the opinion given without the benefit of compliance with the standard of care. In other words,
again, for purposes of malpractice, if you could discuss briefly the patient aspect, how can someone unilaterally make someone a patient?
I don't, first of all, if you read the statute literally, you don't have to be a patient to be malpracticed. A doctor, under a lot of circumstances, can commit malpractice when he doesn't formally have a doctor-patient privilege. The statute says that it describes the standard of care and what one does to commit malpractice, but it does not say with a patient. The best example is this. Doctor gets a call in the middle of the night in the emergency room, doesn't even know the name of the patient, and is asked for advice from an emergency room employee. The doctor's drunk and gives the advice, it's wrong, the patient dies, emergency room patient. There is an argument that the doctor could make, and well, that person was never my patient. And that wasn't the result that the statute intended. The statute intended...
But when the doctor is providing treatment of some type for this individual, you know, and the statute, you're correct, that's the statute doesn't mention patient.
Right.
But it contemplates some type of a treatment to an individual by a provider.
Right. One of the reasons that we cited James versus Brown, the Texas case, was because it really is pretty much on point. You had three psychiatrists who had determined that the plaintiff in the case was of unsound mind and that she should be committed. She was not their patient. Now, in that case, at least they had the opportunity of examining her. and she brought an action against all three. And, of course, the relationship was sufficiently established in those circumstances that she could maintain the action against the one that did commit the malpractice. And there was never any consensual, formal doctor-patient relationship.
And again, I didn't quite read that case, but...
A good case, Your Honor.
Yeah, and I will read it, by the way, but let me ask you this. Was it the commitment proceedings were initiated by whom?
They were initiated by family of the plaintiff.
Right.
Who wanted her committed. Can we talk about foreseeability for a moment?
Before we get there, just backing up to what Justice Perrieri was going down, pursuant to 41A.009, medical malpractice, and it says medical malpractice means the failure of a physician, hospital, or employee of a hospital in rendering service, and that's to use reasonable care, skill, knowledge, ordinarily used under similar circumstances. And I guess I'm troubled under that rendering service. Are they really rendering service to the person they're opining about in this circumstance, as you now want to get into your duty of care?
If we took a very narrow reading of that and said that rendering service means I'm a doctor, you're a patient over here, and I'm going to do something in furtherance of either a diagnosis or a treatment with you directly. And if that's what rendering service means, then we've defined it very narrowly, and you're correct. We have a problem with that. But there are so many other circumstances in which a broader application of the term rendering service. I was asked this one time in relation to the application of the deadly weapon statute. A doctor can malpractice by doing nothing. By doing nothing when he has a duty to do something. He's rendered no service. Yeah, he's guilty of malpractice. And we see it often. Doctor in the emergency room says to patient, go home, you're fine. Patient goes home, drops dead of a heart attack.
It's a failure to provide care, though.
That's right.
And in that particular situation, there was a duty to provide care to that individual.
And that's where we get back to the point where I would like to talk about foreseeability. There is no, I would submit to your honors, there is no malpractice without a foreseeable event. And that's something that we just recognize in tort law. We don't hold people liable when the actions that they're doing could not be foreseen to have caused the injury. And look at this circumstance. We have a medical doctor who is asked to opine as to the mental condition of Mrs. Harrison. And he's asked in the context of what he knows is to be an application to the court ex parte for a custody order. Contrary to the standards, he doesn't meet her, he doesn't give her any tests, he doesn't evaluate her, he never even sees her. Isn't it
was this part of the cross-examination during the hearing?
Pardon?
Was that brought up during the cross-examination of the doctor during the hearing?
Any cross-examination during any hearing. The hearing was ex parte.
Okay.
Which we all know, growing up as lawyers, I think we're all taught that we have a very high duty when we approach the court in chambers ex parte to accurately represent the facts.
How did they arrange for ex parte? How did it happen?
None of family law matters. It's an emergency. We have an emergency. We have a woman here who's not in the right mind, who is a danger to her children. We've got to do something temporarily.
So children,
we get back in here.
Similar to what we did with the temporary restraining orders, and then at a time...
How does that go to malpractice? How do we go from that step to malpractice? Because I think about our grooming cases in sexual assault. Minors, where somebody usually it's a psychiatrist, a psychologist says the defendant's grooming this child and then is going to be a predator and assault this child. And what if it's all wet? What if it just isn't true? And the other thing is records review. Would we ever be able to do a records review by any type of medical doctor, and especially chiropractic cases and stuff? I just worry about, are we going too far by saying this is medical malpractice?
First of all, Your Honor, this is a hired witness. a paid witness, who accepts this job for pay. He is not a treater. He's not an emergency applier of medical care. He's approached and he is offered money to write an opinion. Now, when we get back to the cross-examination, Judge Perigay, a lot of cases talk about cross-examination as the absolute most important tool in arriving at the truth.
Right, but just as when we were all district court judges and had to issue preliminary injunctions without the benefit of the other side until we could schedule a hearing, permanent injunction, which I would imagine is the same process here.
Yeah.
You know, we had the benefit of one side, not the other side.
That's right. They just warned me about my time. Should I sit down?
This is that. You still have 5 minutes left.
Yeah, I want to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, but I guess I'm asking the court if they have questions that they haven't been satisfied with.
You know what? I think you answered my questions fairly well. I had two in particular, so if you want to repeat.
The questions I asked, they weren't treating the medical people. They were just reading the files and saying the guy's a groomer. He's grooming this kid to have sexual relations with the child. And a lot of times you're wrong.
Yeah, and we in Nevada right now, we have sufficient authority in Duff versus Lewis, which is the case I was blocking on. If that person giving that opinion has been appointed by the court, then they're immune. And if they're in court and they testify and subject to cross-examination...
This groomer was not appointed by the court. This groomer was a witness for the district attorney's office. And we have a case on grooming. I think Justice Douglas and I were not too thrilled with the grooming in that particular case. But I don't think you could sue this guy now for, even though the defendant was convicted and went to prison, that you could sue him for medical malpractice. And I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah.
I don't like what happened. I don't think it's, I'm not a fan of ex parte. I think that the family court judge made a mistake.
Yeah.
Ali could have not called counsel in, or at least the party in, is beyond me. I don't know why somebody would do that.
Effective lawyering.
There's never that much of an emergency in life. There's always, you can pick up the phone and say, come on in, and if a judge calls, people usually respond.
I agree, and in the grooming matter, Your Honor, is that a case of this court that sets precedent?
Yes. Well, it was our dissent that we went.
I'm not sure it sets precedent in this particular.
I'm just using that as an example. I'm sure counsel for Dr. Reutemann is going to have some.
I don't know why you couldn't sue a physician if, in deriving his opinion, his actions were below the standard of care. I mean, there was a quote from some case that said, are there no limits? Are there no limits?
Usually, in the cases that support that concept, are usually the cases that you've hired an expert, and the expert in presenting the testimony on your behalf fell below a standard of care.
Yeah.
And they sue the expert.
Yeah, except for the Bush versus Bryce Washington case, in which the people sued their own expert that they hired for not bringing in a high enough figure on.
Right, but this is an interesting case for Nevada.
Yeah.
You know what, I'm going to give you an extra 2 minutes, and I'll add 2 minutes to Mr. Cotton's time
as
well, since we chewed up quite a bit of your time.
Good afternoon, police and court. Hopefully I won't need an extra 2 minutes up here. On behalf of the appellant, we're concerned that the appeal in this case is an invitation to judicial chaos on a number of levels. One, it invites retaliatory lawsuits any time a disgruntled party disagrees with an opposing party's expert. Now, if that were the law, that happens to me about every 3 weeks.
Against
the opposing party. But my clients aren't the patient of that opposing party expert witness. They weren't rendered treatment by that person. That person came in as a retained expert on behalf of the other side to give opinions. And the system's been set up way before any of us started practicing by calling in a hearing. Somebody has a quick hearing like you're talking about here up in Reno. The other lawyer on the other side should get right in there. You have a hearing with that judge. And go any further than that, they have their opposing expert, which they did here. And they can attack him on cross-examination. They can attack him on presenting evidence that they claim isn't appropriate. In this case here, it's my understanding that Dr. Rogan was eventually withdrawn after other experts were put in. That's the way the system works, and it's worked real well for about 400, 500, 600 years.
Mr. Cotton, if we can go back to, since this is kind of a first impression situation for us and trying to grind through what we have in front of us, question is this relationship. Do we have a relationship, a physician-patient relationship? Do we need to retreat back to the Prabhu-Levine case and look at its analysis and looking at departing from the standard of care that the doctor's conduct was the actual and proximate cause of the injury and that the plaintiff suffered damages? Because that's kind of what's there, and it doesn't say that you have to have this kind of what we think of as doctor-patient, and that's part of the problem we're looking at here.
We don't have it defined. It's been defined at common law for years. The Nevada statutes don't directly define it. I submit it's because it's so commonly assumed that that's the law. The practical matter is you can't have somebody be construed as having some form of a physician-patient relationship or a corresponding duty that arises out of that when you know that they're opposing you. They're completely 180 degrees opposite of what the position of the person saying that they're a patient. There was never any retention as her psychiatrist. There was never any treatment of this patient by Dr. Rotman. Wasn't made for this plaintiff's appellant in this case benefit so that she could somehow manage her care going forward. That's contrasted with the situations that you're talking about, where somebody may be a volunteer. They might come in. They
should ask you the same question I asked counsel pursuant to NRS 41A-009, medical malpractice means failure of physician, hospital employee, or hospital in rendering service.
It doesn't
talk about what kind, doesn't talk who, it just says rendering service and to use a reasonable care, skill, knowledge, ordinary, and so on. Huh. But this rendering of service, this doctor rendered a service to someone else about somebody else.
He rendered an opinion as an expert witness. He did not render medical services to anyone here. He looked at it and he came up with an opinion based on the records.
Look at that opinion that you're slicing and dicing. Wasn't it a medical review?
It was his review of the records and his opinion, much like I get in virtually every malpractice.
As a medical doctor.
Okay, but if that's going to be construed as a service, Judge, then you have to construe as a service every opinion I get from some doctor at Cedars-Sinai saying, in my opinion, this person's permanently damaged, they're going to have this, this, and this in the future. That's not rendering a service to that patient. It's a medical opinion. And there's a distinct difference. There's been a distinct difference in the case law for 100 years in medical malpractice cases. And I've had the misfortune of looking at a whole bunch of them over that period of time, but you can't create a relationship out of whole cloth.
Our record is fairly devoid, though, of those hundreds and hundreds of cases you're telling me that there are as that position.
Well, we've got the case that we've cited to you in there that we think is a strong case. The James case, those were court-appointed, pursuant to statute doctors who were rendering treatment. It says it right in the opinion.
Court appointed, and that's kind of where we have this problem in the absolute immunity. We're dealing with people who are appointed or working on behalf of the court, not working on behalf of a particular client. In essence, a hired gun.
Okay, but the problem with the rationale, the path you're going down, is that it ends in a dead end real quick. Because if, in fact, this doctor was rendering service by doing an opinion, then some doctor in California who writes an opinion letter in a case, when my client prevails, is he doing a service then for my client, the doctor? Is he doing a service for the patient that's in that case? You can't abstract it out that far because that's when I say judicial chaos. Personally, I'd have a field day if I could turn around and have the insurance company sue every doctor who came up with a quack opinion and be able to sue them here in this state because that's where their actions took place. I'm not saying that I wouldn't have fun doing that. I just happen to think it would be bad law, and I think it would create bad law if we start stretching out the physician-patient relationship further than logic dictates it should be stretched out.
Does this seem to be a trend? Is this something that's being discussed cross-country, or it's a minority position entirely?
that this occurs, this type of a case? The only ones I've seen are some of the reported decisions we've seen. I'm not aware of any trend at all. I think people recognize what a physician-patient relationship is. You've also got not just physician-patient relationships, you also have a duty. You have to have a duty that arises out of it. Even if he's rendering a service, does that mean he had a duty to a person who never retained him, who he never provided advice to, who he never followed up with as a patient? You've got to have that next level of duty, even if you had a physician-patient relationship. I could have a physician-patient relationship with my internal medicine doctor, but if I get sick on the other side of town, does he have a duty to know I'm getting sick and then follow up with me over there? You've got to have all the facts come into play when you're talking about a medical malpractice case. We can't just exclude some of them because in a case like this, it's convenient. But I'm more concerned here about the medical malpractice implications of duty and physician-patient relationship than I am on the privilege issue, the absolute immunity issue. I don't think you need to address the absolute immunity issue at this point, although I think we're right. I don't know that you need to address it. I think you can address this straight up as not stating a cause of action for the causes that they attempted, the malpractice, which is the underlying cause and the kind of the seminal event of all of the other claims, theory of recovery, as opposed to cause of
action. What was the affidavit like in this case?
Pardon me?
What was the affidavit like in support of the medical malpractice? Well, there was an affidavit with
there were two affidavits, Justice Chair.
Well, this affidavit was submitted, my understanding, up in Reno. I wasn't involved in that case, but up in Reno was submitted regarding some mental issues that Dr. Reutemann had an opinion about. The affidavit in this case, I don't know what.
No, the affidavits there
were some experts who came and said, in my opinion, you have to meet the standard of care. Well, they didn't say that he had a physician-patient relationship. They didn't say that he had a duty to this lady. All they said, in my opinion, rendering an opinion without examining somebody who's below the standard of care. Happens all the time with every type of witness I can think of, not just psychiatrists. If that's the case, about a third of the doctors involved in medical malpractice cases in this jurisdiction are committing medical malpractice or professional negligence. But the bottom line is, even though they said, in my opinion, that was below the standard of care to render an opinion without ever having spoken to her, they didn't say that they had a direct physician-patient relationship, in my recollection, and they certainly can't opine on what is a legal issue. That is there a duty and is there a physician-patient relationship? Those are for this court, lower court first, and then this court to make the determination. An expert witness can't testify that they had a physician-patient relationship or that they had a duty. That's a legal issue.
Did the district court find the statute ambiguous with regard to whether or not physician-patient relationship exists? Do you remember?
Find? I mean, Judge Clare was bothered by the whole concept going forward of that. He didn't sit down and say, in my opinion, this statute's ambiguous.
I think he had to look at the statute to make a determination.
He did, but if you look at the statute in its entirety, all of the medical malpractice statutes, it's very clear as you're going through those that there has to be some kind of a physician-patient relationship for any of the system to work. You know, by definition, the healthcare providers, by definition, what medical malpractice is, there has to be some form of treatment involved, whether it's voluntary or involuntary treatment, or, as you pointed out, defined by statute on the abandonment of the patient type situations like that. You may not be that person's doctor, but the law imposes a duty upon you. Same duty was imposed in the Texas case that Sears. Same duty there. It was a statutory duty in that James versus Brown case that was imposed upon these specific people. But there's no statutory duty here for this expert that says in rendering an opinion in this case here, you have to look out for the interest of the opposing party that hired you. There's nothing that says anything like that for good reason. That's the whole system that we have, is having opposition, having ability to call a hearing in if somebody's been wrongfully pulled in on a temporary restraining order, things like that. Cross-examine them, get your own witness. That's the system that's been set up. It's worked really well for a long, long time. And to get it into a situation where now we don't, if I have to tell an expert, if the court were to reverse this, if I have to tell any expert, and I have to probably under my duties, that they're subject to suit. If the other side doesn't agree with your opinion, you could be sued by the other side because the court's going to say that you have a duty to this person that you were never retained by. I'll never find an expert. I don't think the plaintiffs will ever find experts. It imposes an obligation upon an expert way outside of what their actual relationships are, and I think that that is damaging to our overall system.
Mr. Cotton,
sir?
As you go down this, and I have to ask you, there's some Washington law out there that the Ninth Circuit's opined on, talking about this relationship or lack thereof, but still falling within the malpractice area for doctors. What's your take, or how do you distinguish it?
I think that there have been what I consider some fairly liberal opinions coming out of the Ninth Circuit, and other, and not just Ninth Circuit, some California cases too. My read on that is they're flat wrong. I think it creates a system that kind of defeats everything we're trying to do with medicine in this state, which is have some level of certainty. If we have to worry about not being able to get experts, if we have to go into those situations where they're going to create a physician-patient relationship as an expert witness in a lawsuit, then maybe some case down the line where you could say this person had a physician-patient relationship, at least the plaintiff believed they did, she took actions based upon that and took these medicines and stuff. I can see that situation. I think this is a case-by-case basis, but this is not the case to change that whole issue regarding physician-patient.
Well, the statutes taken as a whole, do they contemplate rendering aid or treatment of some type, even though they don't mention a patient relationship? It seems that if you take the statutes as a whole, they just presuppose that there's a course of treatment of some type or an obligation to provide treatment.
There are the Good Samaritan statutes, and it's interesting you ask that question. There's several different types of Good Samaritan statutes which do provide that if that's not your patient, if you don't have a physician-patient relationship, if you haven't been dealing with that patient, for example, and they have an emergent situation, it happens a lot in OBGYN-type cases, in labor and delivery, where the doctor's not there, somebody needs to have a C-section, and another doctor will step in. They limit any exposure in some of the statutes to zero. But it almost has to be a gross negligence standard, even in that volunteer situation. But they don't construe that as a physician-patient relationship. They construe that as a gratuitous act on the behalf of a physician for a patient in extremis at the time.
Which was a policy issue.
Yes.
And you're saying it's a policy issue just as well here, in the sense that in order for these lawsuits to be fully litigated and for the parties to be able to retain experts without the fear of exposure to liability, it's a policy issue.
I think it is, and if you're in the context of rendering medical services, there may be fact patterns that come up for us all in the future. But at this point in time, we're not talking about medical services in what we consider the classic context. We're talking about an expert opinion report that's issued. This is not rendering a medical service to a patient. It's rendering it basically to the initially to the lawyer who retained the person, and then at that point in time.
Going back to the ex parte aspect of this, is there anything bothersome about that, or was this like a temporary restraining order where there was a full hearing within a relatively short period of time?
I don't know what transpired in that, because it really didn't affect what I was doing here. I don't personally favor ex parte meetings with judges. I know you folks don't either. But it doesn't impact what we're talking about here so much. That would maybe get to a damages issue if someone, in theory, were able to show any kind of a physician-patient relationship. But I don't think it comes up other than that. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Any other questions?
First of all, Norris, I know you can take up whatever issue you want, but we're here on a single issue. The district court dismissed my client's complaint on the basis of Bryce versus Bush Washington case on the question of immunity, not on the question of doctor-patient relationship, duty of care, or any of that issue.
Doesn't duty have to be established first and foremost?
Doesn't it have to be what?
Duty. Doesn't duty in a medical malpractice case or any case have to be demonstrated first and foremost?
Well, I think there has to be a duty of some kind. Was there a duty imposed on Dr. Reutman in this case, working as a doctor and not giving an opinion, diagnosing my client, with narcissistic personality disorder and saying in that opinion there's very little chance that she'll ever get well. Ever. Was there any obligation, any duty on his part to do that within the standard of care? And that's really the issue we're approaching in this case with a hired witness proceeding ex parte. And in terms of this opening floodgates and other doctors not being willing to testify, we probably all had experience where we've asked a mental health professional, look, this person is acting this way. Can you give me, you testify to the mental condition? And that expert says to us, I can, but I won't. I'm required to examine the patient, and I won't do it. And in terms of whether or not this is an issue of moment in terms of future litigation, you know what's singularly absent in this appeal? Amicus briefs. You'd think that if that were possible, you'd hear from the plaintiff's lawyers and the defendant's lawyers, and there'd be some kind of an outrage. The question is, the issue is, it just not doesn't happen that often.
I would think the issue would scare the plaintiff's lawyers just as much as it would scare the defendant's lawyers.
It would scare both sides. Wouldn't you think?
And you were there, so back to the question about the ex parte nature of this. Did a hearing happen and occur within a relatively short period of time?
I wasn't there, but I do know I wasn't Ms. Harrison's counsel in the divorce. He's in the courtroom. You know, could probably pop up and say something.
I'm just curious. Yeah. I'm sure that's what the case was. But
it didn't happen in a short period of time because Mrs. Harrison had, in the face of this 38-page report and opinion and diagnosis that Dr. Reutemann gave, based upon the information spoon-fed to him by her soon-to-be divorcing husband, she had to get experts lined up who could examine her properly and say, no, she doesn't have this, which is what she did do. It's an issue of, we're talking about how the relationship between doctor and patient. Probably a better question is this. Forensically, because we're in the business of justice, all of us are supposed to be, how do we want our paid expert witnesses to behave? Do we want to cloak them in immunity so that whatever they do, we can just say, well, you know, nothing is too far. You get to do whatever you want. When you do it for hire and you know what the consequences can be, or do we want to say, in an orderly system, we want you, before you come before our precious courts of justice, to at least behave the way you're supposed to behave. That's all we're asking. We're not asking for anything extraordinary. Just behave.
I can tell you, doing death penalty cases, as I did as a lawyer, when the state would bring forth people about dangerousness of the people and whether they should be put to death or they should, you know, I think this puts the whole justice system on its ear. And I feel bad for Ms. Harrison in this case. I despise the ex parte nature of it. She should have had a chance to rebut Dr. Reutemann immediately with the judge, you know, in the chambers, right then and there, and a chance to examine Dr. Reutemann, do everything she needed to do. But I just see what's going to happen. I've seen so many witnesses on records review and on so many expert witnesses say things that are so out of line that I have to, as a judge, I have to turn my head because I'm laughing at their thing. And I just don't think you can then sue the expert.
And I'll come back to him right between the eyes. I mean, it's so discouraging as a trial lawyer to be in court and have somebody get up and say something just like that. And that's when you have a chance to cross-examine.
Well, she should have had that chance, but unfortunately we're not doing the divorce case. We're doing the Med-Mal case.
Right.
Justice Perry, before you sit down, in the conclusions of law cited by the district court, they say they're finding one on their third page, absolute immunity is granted to all statements made in the course of or incident to a judicial proceeding so long as they are relevant to the proceedings, citing Sahara Gaming Court versus Culinary Workers Union. And they go on to say, this has been the policy and the rule in Nevada for the last 70 years, and the privileges includes administrative hearings, quasi-judicial proceedings, as well as judicial actions. It is the public's right to know, and so on.
How do you respond to that case being cited as authority?
There are two cases involved. There's culinary workers and there's Sahara Hotel, and both of them involve causes of action based on defamation. And I've got to give that one. I mean, apparently by Nevada law, if someone comes in and defames you in a judicial proceeding, you cannot sue for that defamation.
Should this have been a defamation case rather than medical malpractice?
No, it should not have been.
Why not?
Because it wasn't an issue of a statement, a false statement, which it was, made which hurt her reputation. It was a medical diagnosis given to a court which acted on that diagnosis in an emergency situation to throw her out of her home, to deprive her of the custody of her children, and all basically on the information that her husband had prepared and fed to Dr. Reutemann. Now, to my way of thinking, we're not concerned about the damage to her reputation. The people that know her, her friends, her family, everybody else, know that isn't true.
Well, and we see this in a number of contexts. Parental terminations, when you remove a child from home, you don't have perfect information. It goes before a court personnel, and they make a determination, and it's terribly upsetting to everybody involved. And sometimes it's the wrong decision, sometimes it's the right decision for the safety of the children. And you're working on imperfect information, and sometimes you have to act quickly.
One of the things, criticisms that I hear about the justice system, and I hear it from the denier in juries that I voir dire, and I try jury cases, and that's what I do, is that, well, you can pay anybody to come in and say anything. Well, wouldn't you give an expert witness due credit? Well, I don't know. You got paid to say it. Isn't that something that we ought to abhor?
But it's also part of the obligation of the trial attorneys to overcome that that predisposition that juror may have.
And who's watching the watchers?
Yeah.
When the trial attorneys are so imbued with the prospect of winning that they will hire this person who will say anything for money. Who's watching the watchers? I submit it is this court. This court sets the standard. And it just depends on what the standard this honorable court thinks ought to apply.
All right, well, thank you for the excellent arguments. This is a very interesting case. The issues are certainly interesting, and we look forward to working it up further, and this case will stand submitted.